Okay, so we'll get started again. Three G standards generically have as their goal a sort of improved data services for mobile users. And so before we sort of get into any of the details, we'll just spend a minute anyway looking at sort of who controls what and what do all these acronyms mean. So globally, the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, is the body responsible for 3G standardization. And this does not mean that it is responsible for arriving at a single solution or a single type of network, but rather that it sets the sort of overall requirements of the system in terms of data rates and mobility, etc. And then within that, it allows for different proposed solutions, and it sort of stands over those solutions as meeting the sort of overall requirements. Okay. So IMTS 2000 is a family of standards then for 3G mobile telecoms. So it represents sort of a number of different possible standards, which again have been certified as meeting sort of overall 3G requirements. Okay. And so the reason for this complexity is that, as usual, sort of in the world telecoms market, nobody is doing exactly the same thing. So the US has different approaches to Europe, has different approaches to Japan and the Far East, etc. Okay. So each sort of region has developed sort of their own separate approaches, and then there is some nod towards interoperability, usually in the sense that the handsets can handle multiple different protocols at the same time. In terms of our sort of evolutionary theme, the most important body is 3GPP, Third Generation Partnership Project. And they are responsible for the development of the UMTS standards, which again fit within the IMTS 2000 framework and represent an evolution from GSM/GPRS. Okay. Other bodies have worked to provide other standards. 3GPP2 develops a competing CDMA 2000 standard, and that's an evolutionary step from the US-based systems. Okay. So again, 3GPP is handling primarily the evolution of to UMTS, and it's sort of done this as a series of steps, okay, trying to sort of keep somewhat apace with the sort of actual conditions. And so they've had a number of releases which specified sort of various components of the system. The first release, release 98 in 1998, just sort of it specified the pre-3G networks, so it sort of said, well, this is what actually exists, and let's at least stick to that. And then, again, the various releases after that have sort of added different functionality into this initial base system. Okay, so release 99 was quite significant in that it incorporated a CDMA, so code division multiple access error interface. So again, we've moved from frequency division multiplexing to this code division multiplexing with all that that entails in terms of the use of the frequency spectrum. Essentially, each cell now will be using the entire frequency spectrum, and individual users would then have individual codes distinguishing their channel. Okay, release 4. Specified an all-IP core network. Release 5 specified a multimedia system, which reminds me, I forgot to say what the actual goals of 3G were. So I've said higher data rates, simultaneous use of speech and data services, so you can send everything at once, not have to sort of switch between one and the other. Support for global mobility, and finally, the support for multimedia and real-time services. Okay, so not just providing higher data rates, but actually catering to the sorts of services that they believe users want, such as, you know, sort of streaming videos, maybe voice over IP, things that have real quality of service requirements attached to them. Okay, so the IP multimedia subsystem was sort of a nod towards handling those sorts of services. Sort of release 6, you're also trying to integrate with the rest of the wireless world. So arguably 4G is about sort of heterogeneous networks connecting to different types of networks and to do this seamlessly. And so one step towards that is the integrated operation with wireless LANs. Release 7 improves quality of service. And release 8, 9, and 10 are, again, attempts to move, well, from 3G really into 4G. But to date, those have not actually been finalized. Okay, so they're still a work in progress. Okay, so we have, at this point, the 3GPP has provided a reasonable crack at sort of 3G specifications. And again, it's doing that as an evolutionary step from GSM, from the GSM slash GPRS type of networks. Okay, and technologically, the big difference is in the error interfaces, so the radio equipment used. And so, again, we use all sorts of clever techniques to improve spectral efficiency, so to squeeze more bits into the same frequency allocation. And there is a different spectrum allocation for 3G systems than for 2G. So again, you can't run them on the same equipment because of that. Okay. And UMTS, again, is very interested in offering quality of service, sort of similar to GPRS. And again, that's all based on the ITU standards for quality of service for applications. Okay. So, it's worth saying a few words about the spectrum allocation in technical terms. It's straightforward enough. You sort of move from one portion of the frequency spectrum to another. In a political and sort of business terms, it's been sort of quite complicated. And the handling of the spectrum allocation has arguably sort of set back the implementation of 3G standards. And so Europe is sort of one of the first to sort of think about the allocation of spectrum. And they saw this as a revenue-generating exercise, which is fair enough, but they auctioned the licenses on a sealed bid basis, and operators essentially were very concerned with getting licenses and paid quite high prices for the licenses. And what this meant was, you know, they didn't necessarily have capital then to actually follow through with the implementation of the networks once they paid for the licenses. Okay. Now the rest of the world looked at this and tended to go about the allocation slightly differently, and lower prices were paid in other parts of the world. And indeed, some regions adopted other allocation methods. Hong Kong is notable in it used a profit sharing approach. So you paid for your license by giving up some of the profits you gained from your 3G revenues. Okay, be that as it may, the allocation was made, and again, it's handled slightly differently in different parts of the world. And so in Europe, the allocation is for UMTS systems. In other places, other systems would be in play. And as you can see, again, the UMTS or the 3G spectrum is sitting along with sort of other spectra as well. So the GSM allocation is definitively separate, and in other countries, other systems apply. MSS, if anybody's wondering, is mobile satellite services. So again, connectivity via satellite connection. And the U.S. is sort of interesting in that they've sort of hedged their bets along sort of a number of different types of networks, from mobile to non-mobile operators. Okay. And they've also sort of reserved that higher frequency spectrum. Okay. For UMTS, the spectrum is further split up into different modes of operation. So time division duplexing versus frequency division duplexing, terrestrial and satellite, and then the uplink and the downlink portions of the transmission. Okay. And so you can see that the largest portion is given to the terrestrial frequency division duplex mode, and this is the mode that's sort of currently in operation. Okay. Now, the primary big step or the primary change that's required for UMTS, again, is a change to radio access. And, well, essentially this is true for not just UMTS, but all 3G standards. And so ITU has agreed sort of globally a family of standards which are capable of sort of air interface standards, which are capable of delivering the approved data rates. And some of these are backward compatible. Again, arguably you could squeeze Edge into that. So it's using the GSM spectrum. And others, again, require the new frequency allocation. And so, again, the ones that we're primarily going to concentrate on are the UMTS, terrestrial radio access, or UTRA. But other standards include DECT, which is just cordless phones. So they can deliver the data rates, so they are certified as a standard, even if nobody's really considering using them. And most recently, I think in 2007 or 2008, WiMAX with OFDM, orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, was certified as a standard. And interestingly, the OFDM-based systems are seen as sort of the next step forward, sort of for the 4G systems. People are coming to the conclusion that you can get so far with CDMA, but no farther, and are moving away from that towards OFDM. How long that'll take is anybody's guess. Okay. So in terms of UMTS, again, we have a number of several air interface standards. WCDMA, wideband CDMA, is the most common, and it uses direct sequence spread spectrum. So again, this is the one we'll be concentrating on. But others exist which combine CDMA with time division multiplexing, okay, which is sort of seen as very efficient, although more complex. Again, in the sort of North American telephony world, we have CDMA 2000, which evolved from the CDMA 1 standard. Again, Edge counts, DECT counts, and mobile WiMAX counts. Okay, so you have a lot of air interfaces. Again, the one that we're going to sort of keep in mind is the WCDMA. Okay. So, UMTS, as the evolution from GSM GPRS, is going to introduce a number of changes to the network, although, again, not total revolution. So, in the core network is going to be largely shared with the GSM GPRS and is going to have both circuit switched and packet switched elements. And new to the network will again be the media gateway. Okay, so handling of sort of multimedia services as well as everything else. And again, arguably that could happen within the GSM GPRS context, but it's viewed within this UMTS context, sort of as the evolution occurs. Okay. So the big one is, again, the radio access. And so we have to have new equipment, and Node B is essentially a new name for the base transceivers, base transmission systems. And so they will handle sort of the radio transmission for the system. And then you have radio network, controllers, and again, these replace the BSVs. Okay, so they're equivalent to the BSCs. They're controlling all of the node Bs. Okay, and we should say in that first line controls the node Bs, not the base stations, although they're essentially equivalent, it's just a new name. And so they have to manage all the radio resources, participate in handovers, connect to connect to the MSC and the SGSN. Okay. So essentially, they are the BSC for UMTS. Okay, and again, the user equipment has to change to handle the sort of new radio transmission system. And at a high level, it's going to work similarly to the old one. You need SIM cards, now you have a USIM. And so the functionality is similar, the change is again in the radio transmission. Okay. And sort of additionally, intelligent services are catered for. So, so if you look at this, again, the architecture is similar enough to the architecture for GSM and GPRS. Again, we have a bunch of base stations or node Bs. These are connected to the RNC, which again is the base station controller. And this now connects to core network nodes or elements, the switching system elements that are sort of dedicated to handling different types of traffic. And now again, we've split traffic up into three different classifications. Sort of generic packets, which are handled through the SGSN, voice connections, which are handled through the MSC, and then multimedia connections, so again, streaming videos would be the obvious one, which are handled through this media gateway. Excuse me. Okay, and naturally, interfaces have to be defined between all of the different components of the system, and so the big new interfaces are between the user and the RNC, or sorry, I should say the user and the node Bs. Well, it's actually the user and the UTRAN, so the user and the system sort of over the radio link. Between the node Bs and the RNC, and then between the RNC and the core network, so each of these nodes. Okay. And so, again, the protocols deal with sort of the control of the system and are again broken up into layers. And now, in terms of packet handling, this begins to look more like the OSI model. Okay. So we have our physical layer, layer one. Layer two is, again, the data link layer. And then layer three handles sort of connectivity to the network, sort of the back-end network. Okay. And again, what you need to note is that we still have this division between the control plane and the user plane. So at the user level, essentially you just have a data pipe. So if you're doing a voice connection, you're just transmitting data. It's just like still like a pipe. At the data level, at the packet level, again, you have to do sort of handling of packets. Okay. And so the goal is to sort of do that as efficiently as possible, and again, to handle the radio resources sort of as efficiently as possible. So we now have a sort of dedicated MAC layer, which is going to be responsible for the statistical multiplexing within the system. So multiplexing multiple channels, multiple signals onto a single physical channel. Okay. So the channel structure for UMTS gets again, more complicated. And now a distinction is made between three types of channels. Logical channels, and that's pretty much what we had before, where it just, you know, tells you what sort of information you're sending. Is it a sort of signaling and control information or user information or data, and then if it's control information, is it sort of general system-wide information, or is it between or is it directed to a specific user? Okay. Now, what happens now is that for purposes of efficiency, signals get sort of multiplexed and combined together. Okay, so if you're sending different things to different users, you might send them still along one physical channel. Okay, so there's an intermediate step of transport channels now. Okay, and so the transport channels essentially enable sort of multiplexing of multiple logical channels onto a single physical channel. And then again, as before, physical channels just reflect how the data is transported then. Okay. And so the mappings become quite complex. It's pretty much the same idea. You know, your logical channels eventually map onto specific physical channels. But now, again, you can have sort of multiple logical channels on the same, on a single physical channel. Okay, and that multiplexing occurs at the MAC layer. Okay, so the MAC layer takes logical channels and it's, takes logical channels, it packages them up into transport channels, and then the transport channels get mapped onto the physical channels. Okay, so we'll just look in a little more detail at sort of the specifics of each of these layers. So the lowest layer is, again, the physical layer, and it's the actual radio transmission. And it has to handle the things you would expect. So handover, again, it's sort of intimately involved. It's, you know, where you get the information for the handover decisions, and then, of course, since it's the physical connection, it has to physically change when you're doing handover. Okay. It performs some error detection. Again, some of that's done in hardware for the various coding schemes, and that can be reported to the higher layers. It does the multiplexing of the transport channels. And the mapping onto the physical layer channels. It's responsible for power control, frequency and time synchronization, and everything to do with, again, just transmitting the signal, so performing the modulation, performing the channel encoding, etc. Okay. And so I'm not going to particularly dwell on this, but again, the transport channels have to get mapped into the physical channels. Okay. Okay. So the MAC layer, it does what MAC layers always do. It figures out a way of sharing the resources. And so it negotiates, again, with the higher layers to select an appropriate bit rate for the data. So there's a number to choose from. And again, these would be dependent on the requirements of the application, the requirements of the user, and also the characteristics of the channel. It performs multiplexing onto transport channels. So again, it attempts to make efficient use of the resources available. And it performs its resource allocation sort of based on sort of the quality of service requirements and sort of the global picture. Okay. And so it allows individual users to prioritize among multiple data streams, and it also allows prioritization amongst multiple users. Okay. And, of course, all of the signaling is accomplished on sort of the various channels. So the random access channel allows sort of the requests for resources and the communication of resources, as does the forward access channel. Okay. So the signaling is accomplished, and again, the users are requesting an allocation, and the MAC will respond with, again, when they can transmit their data. Okay, the radio link control is, well, essentially the equivalent of the logical link control. So it's just going to allow for point-to-point connectivity to transport data. And it sort of significantly does this without adding overhead. Okay. It provides two possible services, an assured and an unassured data transport service. So depending on whether you're error tolerant or not, you can sort of choose one or the other. Okay. And again, the functions are very similar to what you'd get for the logical link control. Okay. So you have segmentation and assembly of your data. You have the transfer of user data. You have error correction, sequencing, duplication, detection, flow control, ciphering. So the same things you would expect from the logical link control, but transferred into the radio domain. And then the RRC now is sort of handling that connection moving forward into the network. And so it sort of controls the general link between the user and the network. It performs functions which are required for sort of locating the user within the network. So paging is handled by the RRC. And within a connection, it will sort of handle the establishment and release of the connection. Okay. And so it's has the following functions. It broadcasts the information to all the user equipment. It handles radio resources, so it allocates the codes that are necessary for the transmission of data. So to actually get the channel, you need to sort of have a code. It performs handover, admission control, and anything to do with connections. Okay, it deals with the quality of service, and performs power control, encryption, and integrity protection, so all the security functions as well. Okay, so again, if we think of what the significant changes, we have these new error interfaces, and so again, they're significant in the way they go about sort of packaging or transmitting the data, and so from a user point of view, in the data rates that they offer. And so WCDMA is, again, the most common of the, or the, or the most widely used of the UMTS error interfaces. And it offers data rates ranging from megabits per second, sort of under very good link conditions, to hundreds of kilobits per second in sort of less optimal conditions. Okay. It uses code division multiple access, so you've have chipping codes and sort of distinct codes allow you to distinguish between cells and then between users within the cells. It provides, you know, again, duplexing in terms of an uplink and a downlink. And typically, there's two modes. You can do frequency division duplexing, so two different frequencies, and this is one for uplink, one for downlink. This is typically what's done. And time division duplexing, which would give you different time slots, and this is currently not done. Okay. So the CDMA access, it uses direct sequence spread spectrum. And this gives us improved spectral efficiency. So again, you can pack more bits or get higher bit rate out of the same sort of frequency band. It reduces the co-channel interference. So again, this can lead to improved capacity in the system. And it can improve handover, primarily because it's possible to connect with two base using the system. You can connect with two base stations at the same time. You know, again, if they both know your code, then they can both receive your signal, and this can lead to smoother handovers. We'll come back to that later. And it does also represent a potentially enhanced security for the reason that, you know, if you don't know the chipping code, you know, it's more difficult, or it's very difficult to decode the signal. Okay, so our symbol rate is the rate of the chipping code, which is 3.84 megachips per second. And this is on top of a QPSK modulation scheme, so that gives us 2 bits per symbol, which is a transmission rate of, I should say, signals, a signal rate of 7.68. megabits per second. Okay. And so, again, that's overall signaling rate is sort of spread between a data rate and then the chipping rate. Okay. So, you easily get 15 kilobits per second, and you can get higher data rates by reducing the spreading factors, so reducing the chipping rate. Okay, so the spreading occurs in two stages, and so again, these stages distinguish channels, and then in the first stage you distinguish channels, and in the second stage, then, you distinguish between individual users who have been multiplexed onto the same channel. Okay. So, again, we said that statistical multiplexing is used, multiple users sort of share the channels, and so they have to be sort of distinguished, and so you have the coding helps to the coding does this distinguishing. Okay. So, all of this requires a high level of synchronization. Again, you're going at very high data rates, and you're trying to decode the signals, and so you need high levels of synchronization. And so there are two synchronization channels available, primary and secondary. And so the primary synchronization is sort of a system-wide synchronization, and it's the code used is the same for all of the cells, and is transmitted at the beginning of each time slot, and it allows sort of synchronization of the user with the base station at each time slot. And then the secondary synchronization uses codes that are specific to each base station. Okay, so when the users are actually sort of connected and transmitting, they use the secondary synchronization code as well. Okay. Power control is naturally important. We discussed this sort of generically when we were talking about non-orthogonal systems. So, what you want again is that all of the signals are received at more or less the same power level, in order to sort of distinguish between all of the systems. And so if some signals are received at significantly lower power levels than other signals, then again, you'll start losing bits of the low power signals and not be able to decode them. Okay, so WCDMA uses both open and closed loop power control. And so open loop is used during the initial access, so before you have a link, so before you can actually be, so before you've established the link to allow sort of more specific signaling, power control still applies. And so essentially this is the user equipment will measure the received signal and sort of try and transmit based on that measurement. Okay, and so this doesn't necessarily provide a good estimate of path loss, since it's not necessarily the same as in sort of one direction as the other, but it's the only estimate you have, since, you know, again, there's no feedback loop established yet. Okay, and once a feedback loop can be established, the signal strength is measured in each time slot, and based on that measurement, the power level is requested to move either up or down by sort of one unit. Okay. And so what this gives you is sort of a gradual adjustment of power levels according to the link conditions. Okay. What this means is that the way it's set up is that the power level is always changing. It always goes up or down. But this is not considered to be a problem because in a mobile situation and sort of in a radio situation, it's assumed that things are going to change no matter what. So it's not a problem to be forced that change. Okay. So, again, just to sort of try and make it a little clearer, we'll look at a couple of operations. The first one, cell search. So when a user powers up, again, the first thing they have to do is find a node B or a base station to connect to. Okay. And so this occurs in three steps. The mobile station searches for a primary synchronization channel. Okay, so it's listening for it's listening on these for these synchronization channels, and based on that, it will sort of measure the signal strength and choose the cell with the strongest signal. Okay. Once it's picked one, it synchronizes with that channel and then finds a code group. So it needs the chipping codes in order to decode the signals, so it can receive that from the base station. And finally, it finds the scrambling codes, which allow it to be sort of distinguished within its own, within the code group that it's joined. So again, this is the idea of coding distinguishing sort of a cell and then an individual user within the cell. Okay. And so once that connection is established, the mobile station is allocated a paging group. And so it will monitor the paging indicator channel to see when to see if anybody is looking for it, and then the actual signaling, if it is being looked for, is on one of the common control channels. Okay, so again, when you're setting, if you're setting up a call, you would be paged first, and then you would have to set up the connection, sort of a specific connection to the base station, get your channel allocated, etc. Okay. Handover is obviously very important as well, and well, the modes of handover we'd be primarily interested in are where you're not sort of changing from one type of transmission to another, but you're changing sort of just your cell. Okay, so this is staying within the UMTS framework, so that's why it's intra mode, so within a single mode, within a single protocol for transmission. And in this case, the handover can be soft, softer, or hard. In soft handover, all of the cells are operating on the same frequency, so your CDMA setup. And what this means is that the end user can connect to multiple node Bs at the same time. Okay. So again, if they're all using the same frequencies, all that is needed for that connection is to know the codes. Okay. And naturally, that facilitates a very smooth handover because you have two connections going or two or more connections going at the same time. So if you drop one, you know there's no loss. Okay, softer handover refers to handover within cell sectors controlled by the same node B. So again, if you have a sectorized system, in that case, obviously the frequencies are going to change because that's sort of how sectoring. The frequencies won't change. So that's just controlled within the node B. Okay, and with a hard handover, that multiple connections between the node Bs are not allowed, and this is needed when you are changing your carrier frequencies. Okay, and so again, the decision as to when to hand over is based on a measurement of the signaling quality, okay, and potentially also to sort of optimize the operation sort of globally. I'll just mention it's possible to hand over to different modes of operation. So for instance, you can hand over between a time division duplexing system and a frequency division duplexing system. And obviously that's more complicated. And you can hand over from one system to another. Typically, you would not maintain a connection while you're doing that. Okay. So, in order to set up a radio connection, for instance, in response to a paging message, again, you're going to end up using all layers of the signaling protocol. So, at the highest layer, you have your radio resource control connection request. And here you will try and sort of establish the basic parameters of the connection. So you want to find out whether there are any quality of service requirements. Establish the user identity. So again, all the information to ensure that you're connecting to a specific user, and some initial channel measurements. Okay, and so when you've sort of sent that basic information, you then set up the connection, and so that entails setting up a dedicated control channel, and so you'll need to know the frequency channel number, the power trend, the power control, and then of course for CDMA you need all the coding. Okay. And so once that connection is complete, again you can do the closed loop power control, and you can start sort of two-way signaling. Okay. So the three phases of a connection establishment then are to connect the radio connection. So you start with paging, and you end up with a dedicated logical channel, and you perform power control. Okay. So So that's the channel that establishes the connection between the mobile unit and the node B. And then, of course, that connection has to be sort of moved backwards into the core network. And who handles it, again, will depend on what exactly the connection is. It'll either be handled by the MSC if it's a voice connection, or the SGSN if it's data transmission. Okay, and again, at that level, an authentication procedure will happen, and all of the security measures will take effect. Okay, and finally, the MSC, again, will move that connection back to the wired network. Okay. And so all of these things can be done somewhat independently. Obviously, they have to sort of all be done before connection occurs, but they can be done independently, and that sort of decreases the burden on any single component. Okay, so again, the mobile user is not really, again, really concerned with the connection backwards towards the core network. The only thing the mobile user, for instance, is concerned with is the connection to the base station. Okay, so again, this just goes through sort of what the different steps are. So we start with the RRC, just essentially establishing a communication channel for from the user to the switching subsystem, so just a way of passing control information along. Once that's established, the user can sort of authenticate themselves and perform all the security, and well, the MSC will perform the security, and sort of the setup then is made between the user and the MSC, and then further back to the network. Okay, and once that's done, sort of radio resources can be allocated to the user for the transmission of data. Okay. For efficiency purposes, WCDMA allows for a number of, three different ways of transmitting packet data, pretty much depending on the characteristics of the data. The first is common channel, and so in this case, you're just you're transmitting the data along a shared link, and this can be used for short, bursty packets, and there's no real handover option for it. Again, this is not surprising. You're just sending a small bit of information. You send it off. You don't want to mess with sort of changing the carrier in between sending the small amount of information. For larger amounts of information, you can set up a dedicated channel can be set up, and for this, you have the option of soft handovers and fast power control. But it's connection oriented, so you have the overhead of setting up a connection, or you can share a channel, so do statistical multiplexing. So you have a connection set up, which tells you essentially where your resources are, but then that or what channel you can use, but that channel is multiplexed among multiple users. Okay. And that allows for power control, but not soft handover. Okay. So that's all we're going to say about 3G. So again, there's the goal is for higher data rates, sort of support of data, good support of data applications. In terms of evolution, we've moved from GSM to GPRS to UMTS, and that's sort of somewhat European view. In the US, again, you'd have from CDMA 1 to CDMA 2000. Okay. And the primary way in which this is accomplished is through improved error interface or through new error interfaces. And so the progress, the march moves ever onwards. And so the goals of 4G now are to have even higher data rates, to have all IP networks, and to have sort of heterogeneous networks. So to be able to switch from your cellular network to when you're in a Wi-Fi hotspot, seamlessly switch to that. You might have WiMAX somewhere. So to move between all of the different network technology seamlessly. Okay. And so again, ITU is the standards body sort of globally responsible for defining what 4G is, and they have developed the IMT Advanced Standard. And then within that, sort of various families of specifications and standards exist, and these are documented in IMTS 2000. Okay, so again, you'd have follow-ons from CDMA 2000 into sort of 4G territory, follow-ons from UMTS into 4G territory. Okay, and ITU would just certify that they actually did meet the 4G specification. Okay, so in terms of technologies, again, we've got these ever higher data rates, so we need ever higher spectral efficiency. And currently, it's proposed that orthogonal frequency division multiplexing will replace CDMA. We haven't said anything about that yet. We will when we talk about WiMAX. But it's another way of doing multiplexing. And we have smarter antenna technology, so sort of again allowing to pick up the signals better. More clever error correction, channel-dependent scheduling, and scheduling and sort of resource allocation that supports quality of service, and then link adaptation, so modulation schemes and channel coding schemes that adapt to the link conditions. So we already saw that, but again, they're getting more and more clever. Okay, so 3GPP and 3GPP2 have extended the 3G standards. So UMTS has been extended to LTE, long-term evolution, which again uses orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, and that can be worked into a multiple access scheme. We'll see how later, and MIMO. And also, again, sort of better handling of multimedia services. 3GPP2 has moved to evolution data optimized. And actually, they're currently thinking of moving to LTE. And at the moment, none of the standards completely satisfy the 4G specification. So they're moving towards it, but they aren't there yet. Okay. LTE Advanced is sort of the next step on from LTE, and they hope, meet the 4G specifications, and this is billed to be standardized in 3GPP release 10. Okay, so again, the sequence of releases, and is going to rely on sort of, again, more enhancements to the physical layer. Okay, and again, it's not been released yet. Okay. WiMAX has been submitted to ITU as a competing 4G standard, and it does fulfill the technical requirements, but there's no widespread deployment of it. So, and you can imagine that the mobile operators aren't overly enthusiastic about sort of totally changing everything. Okay. So that's sort of a whirlwind tour of what, if you dig down into the details, is a sort of incredibly complicated subject. But hopefully, again, you get the main points of, again, the evolution and sort of the main techniques that are deployed within this area. After this, we're going to sort of move away from the telephony world and more into the networks world. We're going to look at next lecture we'll look at the local area network side of things, so primarily 802.11, although Bluetooth standards as well. And then in the final lecture, we will look at the WiMAX standards. And so they're, to some extent, trying to do slightly less complicated things. Their main purpose is sort of point-to-point connectivity. They don't have the sort of added issues of sort of a very complex connection management telephony type system. They also don't have the sort of requirements for this universal coverage and handover. Although again, mobile WiMAX is sort of seeking to replicate a lot of that. So that's where we'll go. I think I will ask Martin if he'll be available sort of next Thursday to take maybe the last hour. And again, if you have any questions about the lab remaining, sort of bring them along, and that'll be a good opportunity to sort of deal with any remaining problems. Okay, so I will see you guys next Thursday. Oh, shit. Where is it? Please.
Okay.
Just give me.
Okay.
I don't know where my. Oh, God. Where's my Camtasia gone? it's flashing.
Yes, maybe. Please.
Tried. Okay.
Yes.
So stop.